Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Tommy McNeil reporting. Tragedy in Russia, not far from the capital city, Moscow.
A plane has crashed in Russia, with all 71 people on board believed to have been killed. The flight reportedly disappeared from radar 10 minutes after takeoff in Moscow. Russian news agencies, citing official sources, say there are no survivors. It's thought there were 65 passengers and 6 crew members on board. The plane, operated by domestic carrier Saratov Airlines, took off from Domodedovo Airport. It was destined for the Russian city of Orsk, bordering Kazakhstan. The Russian Transport Ministry is reportedly considering various causes for the crash, including weather conditions and pilot error.
That's Reuters' Jacob Greaves reporting. A key aide to U.S. President Donald Trump is defending the White House's handling of spousal abuse allegations leveled against his former staff secretary before the secretary resigned last week. Presidential adviser Kellyanne Conway told CNN that it's very clear that Rob Porter, who helped oversee paperwork and documents being sent to the U.S. leader, and helped draft the president's recent State of the Union address, did the right thing by resigning after his 2 ex-wives offered evidence that he physically abused them during their marriages. Conway pushed back on numerous news media reports that Chief of Staff John Kelly and White House lawyer Donald McGahn knew for months from FBI security background checks about the allegations the women had. Afghanistan officials say 4 National Intelligence Agency operatives have gunned down 16 of their colleagues before deserting to join the Taliban. A provincial government spokesman confirmed the incident, saying the Taliban also assaulted a center while the insider attack was underway, sparking fierce clashes with Afghan security forces. This is VOA News. A serious military flare-up on the Israeli border with Syria has prompted a response from several nations. VOA's Robert Berger in Jerusalem explains what started all of this.
Israeli warplanes launched several waves of airstrikes inside Syria after an Iranian drone infiltrated Israeli territory on the disputed Golan Heights and was shot down. The Israeli army said a large-scale attack destroyed at least a dozen Syrian and Iranian targets in Syria. An Israeli F-16 fighter jet was also shot down and crashed inside Israel. The 2 pilots were injured and rushed to a hospital. The Israeli military described the drone infiltration as a severe violation of Israeli sovereignty and warned that Iran and Syria are playing with fire.
Since then, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has told his cabinet, "We will continue to harm anyone who tries to harm us." The White House has responded in support of Israel's resolve. Meanwhile, Syria's state media said Syria is responding to new Israeli aggression, while Iranian President Hassan Rouhani has denounced Israel's attacks. Egypt's military says it has killed 16 militants and arrested more than 30 suspects in a major counterterrorism operation that was launched last week, targeting terrorists and criminal elements in organizations across the country. The World Health Organization is calling for resolute action to end violence against children. WHO's appeal comes in advance of a meeting in Stockholm, Sweden this week that will seek solutions to the problem of violence, which affects 1 out of every 2 children on the planet. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA.
The upcoming conference will explore ways to achieve the UN Sustainable Development Goal of ending violence against children by 2030. But the statistics weigh heavily against this aspiration. The World Health Organization reports 1/2 of the 2 billion children on Earth, aged between 2 and 17, are victims of physical, sexual, or emotional violence or neglect. This violence, it says, occurs in the home behind closed doors or in schools. It involves bullying and violent behavior between young people. It says violence thrives in situations of conflict and other fragile settings.
That's VOA's Lisa Schlein reporting. A teenager has won the first U.S. medal at the Pyeongchang Olympics, and it's a gold one. 17-year-old Red Gerard from the state of Colorado in his Olympics debut won the men's slope-style snowboarding competition. I'm Tommy McNeil in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
They tried to charge me. I did not plead to the charge. The court ordered that they take me to Nairobi so that they could prefer their charges. And they cowardly decided to deport me instead.
A prominent Kenyan opposition activist and lawyer prepares to return home despite facing possible immigration and treason charges.
Ultimately, he is seeking a consensus so that the recall of President Zuma can be finalized.
The South African ruling ANC meets Monday as pressure mounts on President Jacob Zuma to step down.
Feeling of confidence and gratitude that the president wants me to represent him at a mission of such importance to Zambia.
And a former Roman Catholic priest becomes Zambia's new High Commissioner to Australia. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Kenyan authorities deported a prominent opposition activist and lawyer to Canada after accusing him of treason. Miguna Miguna was deported last week after participating in a mock presidential swearing-in ceremony of former Prime Minister Raila Odinga at Uhuru Park in the Kenyan capital Nairobi on January 30. The Kenyan authorities forced Miguna onto a late-night KLM flight from Nairobi to Toronto via Amsterdam. His removal flouted Kenyan High Court orders that Miguna be presented to a Nairobi judge 5 days after his arrest. For more on the circumstances that led to his deportation, I reached Miguna Miguna in Toronto, Canada.
Kenya is where I was by choice before I was forcefully returned to Canada. So I did not come back willingly. I've been traveling back and forth. I have a family here. I could easily choose to come back myself, and I've done that many times. Why would anybody think that they have the right over me and power over me to decide where I should be at any particular time?
But Mr. Miguna, you face a charge of treason, and some people said you risk perhaps death if you go to Kenya.
That can only cause fear in someone who is ignorant. I'm a lawyer. I know what treason is, and I know there is no charge like that that can be sustained in any court of law that is managed with even a fig leaf level of competence. So I can't fear that because I know it is trumped up and the courts have seen through it. By the way, I was not charged. They tried to charge me. I did not plead to the charge. The court ordered that they take me to Nairobi so that they could prefer their charges. And they cowardly decided to deport me instead. But clearly these are not people who are willing to go through the process because I would prove them wrong a million times.
If you are not a citizen, how did the IABC approve your candidacy to contest in the elections?
You should ask them. That just delegitimizes their claim. How could I be not a citizen when all my ancestors were born in Kenya and my parents were born in Kenya and I was born in Kenya? So that's just nonsense.
While you were filing official papers, did you ever say that you were a citizen of another country?
Why would I say so? There was no need to say so. There's no legal requirement to say so. I know the law. I know the Constitution. I was part of the team that wrote it. If you travel, and I hope you do, you arrive at the airport and tell them, I came from Nigeria. I came from Ghana before I came to Canada or the U.S. I mean, you would be crazy. Why would you do that?
So what made you support Raila Odinga? Because you fell out spectacularly. What made you support him this time? Because people reported that you said he shouldn't be president.
I fell out with Raila for specific reasons. And those reasons have never been waived, never been cancelled, never been invalidated. But Raila Odinga won the August 8, 2017 elections. I am not one to turn my mind away from that reality. The fact is he won. Why wouldn't I support somebody who won and whose election was stolen? Just because I disagreed with them yesterday. The reason why I disagreed with Raila was over integrity, was over truth, was over corruption, which I opposed, which he tolerated when he was prime minister, which he now realizes I was right, because I told him to avoid these people that put him in a ditch in 2013 elections. And he ignored me at the time. I told him to support a parliamentary system, and he supported a presidential system, the current system that has now put him in a ditch. And he recognizes that. He recognizes that I don't support people because they are powerful, because they have money, because they have power over me, because they are my employers or anything like that. I follow the truth. I follow evidence. I follow facts. I use logic. I've remained consistent.
What is the actual story behind Raila's deputy presidential candidate, among others, who failed to attend the swearing-in ceremony at Uhuru Park?
Raila is the one who won the election. He was the presidential candidate and he was sworn in. That is a question for those people to answer. I'm not going to waste my time with people like that. It's up to them. Really, what can you say? If somebody ran for elections, the election victory was stolen, and they're not willing to fight to get back that stolen victory, I can't answer for them. They have to be able to justify why. If it is cowardice, so be it. Let them deal with it.
What is the end game here for NASA leadership, Raila Odinga, and for you as well?
I'm not in NASA. I never joined NASA. The fact that I am saying Uhuru Kenyatta is an illegitimate president and must be removed so that a legitimate one who was elected by Kenyans should assume power, or we go through another election so that Kenyans have, through their vote, elect a person of their choice, doesn't mean I'm in NASA. I ran for elections on August 8th, 2017 as an independent candidate, but I lead the National Resistance Movement Kenya, which is a movement which has nothing to do with NASA.
So what are the prospects of Raila Odinga becoming the legitimate president of Kenya, as you have said? And what is the position, if I may ask you, do you think Uhuru Kenyatta would occupy in Kenya?
The president of Kenya, legitimately elected by the majority of people in Kenya, is Raila Amolo Odinga. Uhuru Kenyatta is an illegitimate usurper of power. So his position at State House is very tenuous and temporary. More than 70% of Kenyans do not recognize Uhuru Kenyatta as their president. When last, on the 12th of November, he went for Jamhuri Day, just less than a month after he was allegedly elected, that demonstrates to you how unpopular he is. When on the 30th we inaugurated Raila Odinga at Uhuru Park in Nairobi, more than a million people showed up. That demonstrates to you the popularity of Raila Odinga. That's not something somebody can wish away. So it's just a matter of time, not when, before Raila Odinga replaces Uhuru Kenyatta as the president of the Republic of Kenya.
Miguna Miguna is a prominent Kenyan opposition activist and lawyer. He spoke with me from Toronto. Senior members of the African National Congress, or the ANC, the South African ruling party, is scheduled to hold a special meeting in the capital, Pretoria, Monday. The National Executive Committee meeting comes as members of the ANC pressure President Zuma to step down over charges of corruption. Officials say the powerful executive committee has the power to force the president to resign. Local media report Zuma as saying he will resign before his final full-year term expires in the middle of next year, ahead of the 2019 elections. For more, I reach a South African independent policy and political analyst, Dr. Sumadu Dafikeni, in Pretoria.
Well, the expectation is that the president of the ANC will report back whatever negotiations he had with President Zuma in terms of the transition that will lead to his stepping down. They may reflect on whether the terms of stepping down are accepted or not, but ultimately he is seeking a consensus so that the recall of President Zuma can be finalized.
It appears that President Zuma has been facing pressure internally to resign. The South Africa Communist Party that formed an alliance with the ANC wants him gone. The opposition wants him gone. So who are his supporters at the moment within the ANC?
There are people who were his staunchest supporters who, ironically, they are also involved in some of the corruption charges, and they are likely to appear in the commissions of inquiry that include the Secretary General of the newly elected leadership and his deputy. So to that extent, in the National Executive Committee of the ANC, which is meeting tomorrow, there are people who do have their own personal interest at stake. But not only that, some of them who were appointed to be ministers do know that once Jacob Zuma is removed, there is likely to be a cabinet reshuffle, and they are likely ever to be in the cabinet again, because either they were performing poorly or they were involved in a number of suspected corrupt activities.
Some South Africans are saying Zuma's chicken are coming home to roost, and that what he did by forcing former President Thabo Mbeki to step down is the same thing that is happening to him now. Do you share in that assessment?
To some degree, that is the case, that people are beginning to compare the two scenarios. But Thabo Mbeki, at the time, there were no reported corrupt cases. And at the time, ANC was still very high in terms of its electoral support. But this case is a worst-case scenario for Jacob Zuma, because he faces far more serious charges and corruption charges, as well as all kinds of charges of having divided and collapsed the ANC.
Some people are speculating that the negotiations for President Zuma to step down included immunity from prosecution of the over 700 corruption charges against him. What are you hearing on the ground?
That is most unlikely, and many people are quite aware of that, that it is out of question. South African constitution and the rule of law doesn't allow for anyone, including the president, to have immunity from the charge. Instead, what is coming out is that he might actually be trying to persuade government to fund his legal fees as he faced mounting legal challenges, because he would say he was doing these things as the head of the state. The other one is he's calling for the security of his family once he is gone. And the other long shot might be, if I'm found guilty, the president of the country, who is likely to be the president of the ANC, could consider pardoning me once I've been found guilty.
Dr. Fikeni, do you anticipate Jacob Zuma holding on to power despite this pressure for him to step down? And what will be the chances of the ANC were he to hold on to power till the election period?
If President Zuma, as the president of the country, stayed on despite the public calls, the calls by the opposition, then it would weaken and compromise the ANC. He has become a political risk for them. And besides, already we've seen unprecedented experiences, such as the cancellation of the State of the Nation address and the cancellation of a number of important functions. So the country cannot go on in this state of paralysis. So the mounting pressure on the ANC will force them to be more decisive in their meeting tomorrow. So we would expect that, if not this week, very soon, President Zuma will step down.
Dr. Somadu Dafikeni is a South African political and policy analyst. He spoke with me from Pretoria. A former Roman Catholic priest has been sworn in as Zambia's High Commissioner to Australia. Father Frank Bwalya is scheduled to leave this week to Australia, where he will represent President Edgar Lungu as the country's top envoy. Bwalya, the former priest, quit his role in church after forming an opposition political party before joining the ruling Patriotic Front to become the party's deputy spokesman. To get a reaction following his new appointment, I reached Father Frank Bwalya in the Zambian capital, Lusaka.
Well, it was an exciting experience, very fulfilling. I was overcome by a sense of gratitude, because it shows that the president has confidence in me, and he trusts that putting me in that position, I can do a good job to represent him. Because as High Commissioner, I go to represent the president, who represents the people of Zambia by the mandate that they have given him to govern the country. But I must also say that I've been discussing with the president something not very far from what has happened now, from 2015 when he became president. So it wasn't entirely something that I never anticipated, per se. Nevertheless, it didn't take away the excitement and that feeling of
confidence and gratitude that the president wants me to represent him at a mission of such importance to Zambia.
When were you notified that the president wants you to be the next High Commissioner to Australia?
I was notified by a message of the swearing-in because I was in class doing a course in diplomacy and international relations through self-sponsorship. So I had just left class and I found too many messages on my phone from cabinet office indicating urgent. So I had to call one of the numbers, which was a land phone, a fixed phone, and I was told it was from cabinet office. So that's how I went there and I was informed that I'd been appointed by the president and that I'd be required to attend the swearing-in ceremony the following day. And from that moment, everything became rapid because a lot of things had to be done in order to fulfill that function, which was going to happen in a few hours' time the following day.
Specifically, what did the president tell you when he swore you in as his next High Commissioner to Australia?
Well, firstly, the president said a few things about the personal relationship that he has with me, which I think is important when appointing an ambassador or high commissioner, because the president wants to demonstrate that he personally knows the person that he's appointing, and also to show that the confidence in this person is something that is genuine, it is something that has developed over time. So he said something to that effect. He even mentioned how we worked together when I was Media Institute of Southern Africa, Zambian chapter, board chairperson for the National Governing Council, and he was our lawyer. Then he talked about my capacity, that he believed that I'd what it takes, and so on. Then to the more important issue, that he expected me to do a good job and to represent him and the country, and talking about the importance of this mission, Zambia being a mining country, the same kind of experience in Australia, diversification, and so on. So these are some of the things that he mentioned.
Will you remain engaged with the media back home, or will the demands of your new office prevent you from doing so?
I want to believe that the media is a vehicle. It gets you to the public. And I think that anyone in public office should see and appreciate the value of such a vehicle. I'll be doing a job representing the president, who represents the people of Zambia. The people of Zambia, through their president, would be entitled and interested to know what is happening in that mission, how Zambia is benefiting, and so on. And they would also be interested to know what their High Commissioner is doing. I may not be in the media all the time because of the nature of the job, but I must say that I would never abandon the vehicle called the media. So I would still be friendly to the media. I would still be giving them stories, not just those generated from my office, but even other things happening in Australia that may be of value, of importance to what is happening back home in Zambia.
Some critics are saying that this is job for the boys because you have been a praise singer of President Lungu since he was elected into office. That is why he gave you the job. What is your response to that?
The president has given me the job because he has confidence in me. He needs somebody to represent him in Australia in the same way he needs people to represent him in other missions around the world. And this is one of those appointments, the political appointment into civil service, which, according to the lecturers who are teaching us at the Zambia Institute of Diplomacy and International Relations, say it is at the discretion of the president. And the president is not bound by any requirement in terms of who he should appoint. In fact, one of the lecturers went to an extent of saying that the president can even appoint the first lady's wife, his children, and anybody, because he's allowed to do that. So at the end of the day, the president is supposed to appoint somebody that is confident of representing him well.
Father Frank Bwalya is the new Zambian High Commissioner to Australia. He spoke with me from Lusaka. A norovirus that left officials at the Pyeongchang Olympics scrambling to contain it means athletes might have more to worry about than just going for gold. More than 100 people have come down with this dreaded stomach bug. VOA's Carol Pearson tells us what it is, how it spreads, and what precautions athletes and others can take to keep the virus in check.
South Korean Olympic organizers called in the police to take over from quarantined workers after some tested positive for the norovirus, a stomach bug that causes nausea, vomiting, and diarrhea. Dr. Cynthia Sears, an infectious disease expert at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine, spoke to VOA by Skype.
Norovirus is a virus that's exceptionally contagious. It can be spread by simply touching surfaces.
The norovirus can survive for days or even weeks on a variety of surfaces. And Sears says it only takes a small amount of the virus to infect someone.
It can be spread by vomiting, and because it can aerosolize to some extent, people can pick up enough that way. It can be spread through the stool if you accidentally get a little bit of feces on something.
The virus spreads quickly between people, especially in close quarters like cruise ships and nursing homes. It can spread wherever there are crowds. The norovirus can also be passed on through contaminated food and water if the person handling the food or water has the virus, or if that person gets fecal matter on the food or in a drink. Symptoms normally last for a few days, but afterward the sickness causes fatigue. The antidote is cleanliness. If food preparation surfaces are disinfected and the food is cooked thoroughly, the virus's ability to survive is reduced. The best defense is lots of hand washing and disinfecting any surfaces that might be contaminated, especially kitchens and bathrooms, and keeping your fingers away from your face. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
Cameroon says its northern border with Nigeria and Chad and most of the Lake Chad basin face a food crisis. This because of desertification and the Boko Haram conflict that stopped farmers from doing their work. For VOA, Moki Edwin Kenzeka reports from Garoua in northern Cameroon.
Thousands of school children selected from all primary and secondary schools plant trees on the outskirts of Garoua, capital of the northern region of Cameroon. Diden Jongwe, an official of Cameroon's Ministry of Secondary Education, says children were invited to plant trees because temperatures have risen to up to 48 degrees Celsius from 42 degrees Celsius in the past couple of years.
Ces enfants, à partir de là, vont comprendre qu'il y a une nécessité citoyenne à protéger son environnement.
He says by planting trees, the children will understand that it is a citizenship duty to protect the environment and keep it healthy for living, both for themselves and future generations. Jongwe says each school in Garoua is expected to have students water the trees on a schedule until the rainy season begins. Up to 90% of rainfall in Garoua comes from June to September, and evaporation, the government says, has been very high with harsh, hostile and fragile climatic conditions. Sally Saini of Cameroon's National Action Plan for the Fight Against Desertification says Garoua is one of the towns in northern Cameroon witnessing the worst effects of desertification and land degradation.
Environ 8 millions d'hectares sont déjà complètement désertifiés, c'est-à-dire que incapables déjà de produire. Ça veut donc dire que
he says more than 8 million hectares of arable land has either been completely destroyed or is losing its fertility to a level it is becoming impossible to grow crops, which is a very serious handicap to agricultural production. He says all the degraded soil should be restored through tree planting and the construction of water wells and boreholes where possible. Seni says the phenomenon has worsened over the years, triggering a vicious cycle of environmental degradation, leading to poverty, food insecurity, and mass migration in dry areas. Hansen Langmia, Cameroon Country Director for the World Wildlife Fund for Nature, says the situation is getting serious because of decreasing rainfall and water shortages and wildfires and the cutting of trees for fuel.
Our rivers will dry up and a lot of things will happen and we will face the impact. The heat we are facing is because the ozone layer that is supposed to be protecting the earth is being destroyed by overexploitation of our resources and the release of gases that are destroying the ozone layer.
Cameroon reports that 40% of its northern border with Nigeria and Chad has been affected by desertification, and it has resulted in famine, threatening 30% of the 3 million people of the far north region, including over 80,000 Nigerian refugees and 100,000 internally displaced persons. The Central African State says the situation may grow worse because the Boko Haram insurgency has prevented farmers from working their land, and by so doing, food production has dropped. The situation is also bad in neighboring states of the Lake Chad Basin that depended on Cameroon for their food supply, as the insurgency has moved. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Garowa, Northern Cameroon.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Mpuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Juna, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Mpuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hello, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. North and South Korea competed together for the first time at an Olympics on Saturday, as the first of 102 gold medals were decided. Kim Yong-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, was among a high-level delegation in the stands as the joint Korean women's ice hockey team took on Switzerland in the opening match. There was joy for South Korea when short track speed skater Lim Hyo-jun won the first gold for hosts on day one, claiming the men's 1,500 meters in front of a near-capacity crowd. Earlier, Sweden's Charlotte Kalla won the first title of the games in the women's skiathlon, followed by Germany's Laura Daimler, who triumphed in the women's 7.5-kilometer sprint biathlon. Five gold medals were up for grabs on day one, including with Camille Stoch's attempt to become the first back-to-back ski jumping champion in the Nomo Hill. But most South Korean fans were fixated on the ice hockey, where the combined North and South women's team appeared at a packed Kwangdong Hockey Center. The two Korean matched together at Friday's opening ceremony, but they have never before competed side by side at an Olympics. Elsewhere, a new Athletics World Cup will take place in London this summer, with eight top nations competing. The inaugural competition is scheduled for July 14th and 15th, the same weekend as football's World Cup final in Russia and the Wimbledon tennis finals. Britain and the US will take part, along with South Africa, Poland, France, China, Germany, and Jamaica. One male and one female athlete from each nation will compete in all field and track events up to 1,500 meters. The countries will be competing for prize money of $2 million over two evening sessions at London Stadium. To mark 100 years since British women were given the right to vote, the first edition of the event will see all nations select a female athlete as team captain. Elsewhere, Frenchman Abraham Kipterich won the first edition of the 2018 Access Bank Lagos City Marathon 42-kilometer race. The Kenyan-born 32-year-old finished in 2 hours, 13 minutes and 4 seconds to emerge the winner on Saturday, winning the grand prize of $50,000. Abraham's time set a new Lagos marathon record, 3 minutes better than the record set by his fellow compatriot Abraham Kiptum in the second edition of the tournament held last year. Kenyan duo of Rone Kipkoech Kibos and Benjamin Bitok took second and third, winning $40,000 and $30,000 respectively. In the female category, it was a clean sweep for Ethiopia, as the trio of Alemeneshi Harper Guta, Tigist Gima Gatechu, and Aliyu Abebe Hadofa came first, second, and third to win $50,000, $40,000, and $30,000 respectively. Ilia Palm was the first Nigerian to finish the 42-kilometer race in 2 hours 40 minutes, and he also had a hefty prize. There were also prizes for Nigerians in the newly introduced 10-kilometer race, which saw Sajo Ismaila, a male, and Ona Sala, a female, drive home a brand new saloon car each and other mouth-watering prizes. Finally, the Senegalese Football Federation has confirmed that the Teranga Lions will play Bosnia and Herzegovina and Luxembourg in friendly internationals ahead of the World Cup in Russia later this year. The West Africans will play Bosnia on March 27th in France and Luxembourg on May 31st. Senegal see the Europeans as similar opposition to Poland, who they will play in the opening Group H fixture at the World Cup. Senegalese officials are also in advanced talks with Croatia and Estonia for friendly dates in June ahead of the tournament in Russia. At their first and only World Cup appearance in 2002, Senegal, led by current coach Aliou Cisse, reached the quarterfinals and beat a star-studded French side in the group stages. This time round, Senegal will have to get past Poland, Colombia and Japan in Group H of the tournament in Russia. The Teranga Lions will begin their World Cup Group H campaign against Poland on June 19th in Moscow before they play Japan on June 24th and then Colombia 4 days later. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent.
If no be God, for me, I'll be a nobody, nobody. But for God, who I be, I'm a somebody, somebody. Giovanna, my superstar. Giovanna, my superstar. Alpha and Omega, my superstar. And he said, I give it all to you. I'm nothing on my own. I have nothing of my own. I have no power of my own. I have no power of my own. 'Cause you're my greatest superstar. Now you give me the cow. So that everywhere I go, now you got. I'll be a nobody, nobody.
Johnny, where is my Johnny? come on back for them. Tell them say run for them. Sugar boy, give them the run. And you know
and we live for the party, for nobody. We live for the party. Oh Lord have mercy. We live for the party. No, you no send nobody.
I say we live for the party. Oh Lord have mercy. Hola, hola. We popping balls.
Hola, hola.
We making noise.
Myself, lady tonight, are you sure you can take this love? DJ jam this song, all my people sing along. We live for the party, for nobody. We live for the party. Oh Lord have mercy. We live for the party. No innocent, no.
I say we live for the party. Oh Lord have mercy.
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospects in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's One Man's Point of View with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Today, February 11, marks the 28th anniversary of Mandela's release from prison in response to the international demand for his release. This is why today a major event is taking place in Cape Town, and South Africans remember that day in 1990 when Mandela and his then wife Winnie Mandela walked through the gates of the prison to a joyous crowd and to an international community seeing it as the harbinger of the end of the apartheid regime. This year also, 2018, represents the 100-year birthday of Nelson Mandela. But while the international community joined the people of South Africa in celebrating this event, dark clouds over around the African National Congress, a party of Nelson Mandela. And this may explain why last Friday, the ANC issued an information that none of the big three leaders of the ANC would be available for any pre-event celebration until today for fear that there might be disruption by the media asking about the future of the state president, Jacob Zuma. The reason why there is so much turmoil in the ANC today is because the party congress in Johannesburg in December last year did not resolve the division within the ANC. It is true that Cyril Ramaphosa won the presidency of the ANC, but his victory was very narrow. And when one takes into account the composition of the National Executive Committee and the Big Six, it is easy to see that the two factions, the pro and anti-Zuma faction, are evenly divided, and neither is in a position to offer a knockout blow. On the other hand, the anti-Zuma faction outside the structure of the ANC is a very powerful one and has given the edge to Cyril Ramaphosa. And that faction is composed of the opposition parties, section of the media, and many prominent non-party officials of the ANC. You hear more from them than you normally would hear from the Zuma faction. Why then do we have all these rumors and misstatements that Zuma is about to be either recalled or resigned? And these rumors and misstatements reached a fever pitch last week when it was announced that State President Jacob Zuma would not be allowed to make the state speech in Parliament last Thursday. In fact, the Democratic opposition in Parliament moved that he should not do so and should be removed before that date. There were reports that the National Executive Committee will either demand the removal of Jacob Zuma or his recall before Thursday. The next we heard is that speech was cancelled and also the meeting of the NEC was cancelled. So we are in this situation, whereas while one is happily remembering that day in 1990 when Mandela was released from prison, which was the highest point of the ANC, that we now have a very difficult time for the party. Now, what is for the future? The anti-Zuma faction has one trump card. And that trump card is to allow an impeachment vote to succeed in Parliament. But could you imagine what will be the future of the ANC if its member allowed a motion tabled by the Democratic Alliance giving that party's origin to defeat an ANC president? Zuma also has one trump card, and that is an unspoken one. the possibility that if pushed to the corner, his faction might leave the ANC and form their own party, which would mean that Cyril Ramaphosa may not be certain of victory this year. So this is the reason why the only possible thing available is a negotiated arrangement satisfactory to the two factions of the ANC. Unfortunately, the price that Zuma may ask may be too high. According to reports, he wants the charges against him to be dropped and also wants the ANC to help pay for his legal fees. However, as South Africans go to bed tonight, they should know that these vultures are hovering over Mandela's ANC. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, Managing Editor Shaka Sali, Reporter Douglas Mpuga, Producer Saida Hamdoun, and Engineer for today, Mr. Zoniak, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, if a lizard decides to wear trousers, it should know where to put the tail. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The State Department announced in January that Iran has been redesignated as one of the 10 countries of particular concern for engaging in or tolerating systematic, ongoing, and egregious violations of religious freedom. The state of religious freedom in Iran remains extremely poor. Human Rights Monitors report that Shamiram Isavi, the wife of Victor Bet Tamrez, who formerly led Iran's Assyrian Pentecostal Church, has been targeted on the basis of her faith and sentenced to 5 years in prison for supposed crimes against national security. In July, her husband was sentenced to 10 years on similar charges. The couple's son, Ramiel, has also been accused of purported national security crimes because of his faith and his father's ministry. Human Rights Monitors note that Christian converts are being increasingly targeted in Iran, with at least 10 individuals receiving long prison terms over the past year. The persistent repression of Baha'is in Iran continues as well. The Center for Human Rights in Iran reports that imprisoned Baha'i teacher Ozitoh Rafizodeh was recently told she would be granted furlough from prison only if she repented and apologized for educating Baha'is online. She and her husband, Peyman Kushk Baghi, also a teacher and a member of the Baha'i community, were arrested in 2015 and convicted of national security crimes and of belonging to an illegal group. Baha'is have long been one of the most persecuted minorities in Iran, as a new online archive of official documents, news articles, audio recordings, and other primary sources established by the Baha'i international community demonstrates in great detail. Designating Iran a country of particular concern because of the government's ongoing violations of religious freedom demonstrates the importance the United States places on respect for this human right. As President Donald Trump said in his proclamation on Religious Freedom Day, January 16th, the United States is the paramount champion for religious freedom because we do not believe that conscience rights are only for Americans. We will be undeterred in our commitment to monitor religious persecutions and implement policies that promote religious freedom. Through these efforts, we strive for the day when people of all faiths can follow their hearts and worship according to their consciences.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.